Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Welcome to the WeChat Tech podcast.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
No worries. How are you?
I'm all right. Yeah, not bad. Not bad. You know, feeling good. Had a nice long weekend. Feeling relaxed. Yeah.
Nice. Good stuff. Look, Dave, just for our audience, why don't you give a quick intro into yourself?
Sure. So I'm a DevOps lead at Simply Business. We have a relatively large DevOps team. So I help, along with another lead, manage our DevOps infrastructure at Simply Business. I've had a very varied career, which we can go into, coming from like help desk through a few different things into DevOps. And here we have a pretty amazing team. We've got 9 of us in the team. We're elite as far as Dora metrics go. And so we're doing around 5,000 deploys a month, and that's around 200-ish or so, give or take, core business apps, and then a few others around that as well.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Fair play. What drove you into IT, Dave, in the first place? Obviously, you're from Australia, right, as well?
Yeah.
One thing I should have asked that beforehand. Yeah. So what drew you into IT?
I always loved computers. I think when I got my first computer, trying to figure out how to get that working, I really loved I think it was like Windows 95, and sort of just booting it up and getting it working and trying to hack that together. I really loved. I actually didn't do very well in high school. And so I started off working in the Australian equivalent of Currys in the computer department. And then I decided to... I decided to do a Microsoft certification, MCSE, which was a big risk then. I think it was about like half my yearly salary on this certification. But I heard it was kind of the way in to get your job. So I did a MCSE, and I think it was NT4 back then, and I managed to get a job in help desk. And then from there on, kind of worked my way up into different levels of tech. Yeah.
Nice. So how did you get into DevOps?
That's a really interesting story. So I started at Simply Business managing what we call the BizOps team, which is IT support and IT infrastructure. So that team when I started was 5 people. And you kind of had your IT support on one side of the team, you had your IT infrastructure on the other side of the team. And the company, I think, was around 250 or 300 people. The company in a few years grew from 300 people to about 1,200 people. We did an international expansion into the US. And so the team that I managed went from 5 to about 23, 24 eventually. And that we had a US support team, a US infrastructure team. We had infrastructure and support teams in the UK, service management, this sort of thing. And it was a very, very interesting experience for me. I really loved it. You know, it became very much about strategy, which I really loved. And a very, very exciting time to grow a team like that. But as I sort of went into leadership, I became a lot more disconnected from the hands-on stuff, from the tech stuff. And I love tech stuff. I love coding. I love hacking away at things and building things. And so the opportunity came up in the DevOps team. And I took a kind of a sidestep to go into that and actually get a bit more hands-on, which was a big learning curve. And yeah, there was a lot to learn. You know, we have a quite a highly customized platform built in AWS. But it's, I kind of like, you know, when you first see it, it just seems, at least from when you're from the build side, from the user side, I think it's relatively okay. But from the build side and actually configuring it, it has its complexities. So kind of learning that and the learning curve was high. But I sort of, you know, did it, stuck around, and now I'm really loving it. Yeah.
It sounds like you're a pure techie at heart. How was your how did you find the leadership front? Because I know you said you preferred sort of the, you know, the hands-on techie side of things. How did you find the sort of managing, leading side of things? And what's your approach to it? Like your leadership approach, would you say? Like what's your style?
So it's kind of funny because I love tech, but I also have masters in management and also a master's in business as well. So and a lot of both of those degrees, where those masters, have a lot around management stuff like that. And so in Australia I got the master's of management, and in the UK I got the MBA. And to answer your question, I loved it. You know, it's really interesting. Like for me, leadership is about you know, giving people the opportunities to excel, and you know, like just pulling stuff out of the way to make sure that they can be their best and bring their best to work and do the best. So for me, that was really interesting. There was a lot of people that I was able to grow. You know, I had someone who was a sort of senior technical person who became a infrastructure lead, another person who started as an engineer and then became a service desk lead and then effectively BizOps manager, my old role he went into. And that was really great to see him, you know, coming from, you know, from infrastructure into like seeing him really excel doing service desk stuff. So for me, like being able to grow people and grow teams, we also had a thing where we brought people from the contact center into IT. So people who were answering our lines for insurance, you know, we sell insurance, and we gave a lot of people an opportunity to start their journey into tech through the BizOps department, which was really cool.
Yeah. I think the most rewarding thing with any sort of form of leadership is seeing other people like progress and how you can help them.
Yeah.
I think it's so rewarding.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I was like leading a few people before, and honestly, it's just to see him grow in the role.
Yeah,
it's really rewarding. But you're still a techie at heart, so
definitely. I think that's the best part of leadership. I think it's really, really lovely. But yeah, it's just I really miss the tech. You know, it really like I remember there was this one time I was working over Christmas. I decided to not take Christmas off, and I got to do a project. We migrated something. And I got really excited about it. I was like, yes, I get to get my hands dirty again, you know? And so, yeah, that was really like, that was for me, that was a big thing to come to. But if I'm honest, if we're talking candid, it was a hard decision, you know? It was really, I enjoyed leading a large team. I enjoyed building that. There's really interesting sort of challenges. And then to go to something like DevOps, so I'm an infrastructure person. I started in IT support and came to infrastructure. I did contracting infrastructure. And so I love, you know, building servers and automating stuff. But DevOps is sort of, you know, the step beyond that. So that learning curve was tough, you know, that was tough. Very rewarding, but very tough. Yeah.
I think like leadership for me, I think there's so many facets involved in it. Like there's emotional support, there's leading on the sort of technical front, there's like psychological sort of components as well.
Mm.
So I think for me, we were both leads in our last company and like, I don't think I was that good at it.
No, yeah, right.
Yeah, it wasn't for me. I actually made a post on LinkedIn about this about a month ago saying that the next step up is not always a leadership role. You can sort of lead in other ways. So I think for me, I just didn't enjoy
Did you?
It.
Really?
He was really good at it as well. I think he sort of like commands respect, whereas I sort of like, I'm good at my job, but I'm not good at sort of teaching others.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I like seeing people grow.
Yeah.
I like doing the work, but I like to help other people accomplish what they want to accomplish as well.
Yeah.
It's rewarding to see that.
Yeah.
That's what I really enjoy.
Yeah, totally.
I must be selfish.
I think it's so interesting because like leadership, I don't think it's a thing like you have it or you don't. I think it's a skill that can be developed. You know?
Yeah.
But I think in my, I guess, 20 years experience now, I feel like if you do what comes naturally to you, that can make things a lot easier, you know? And so if leadership doesn't come naturally to you,
don't force it.
Exactly. Yeah,
totally. But that can be hard when you're sort of, to get the next pay rise, you have to go into that in some companies. I think that can be sort of like, you get forced into it that way as well.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you can't really progress that much in the role. So
totally, yeah.
It's tough.
It is. Yeah, we have that's something that we just sort of challenged here. And I think a lot of tech companies, you know, like you've got junior, mid, senior for developer, DevOps engineer, whatever. But then what happens after that? You've got these people that are amazing DevOps engineers.
Don't want to leave.
They don't want to leave.
Yeah.
But where do they go? You know? Yeah.
Challenge. I think it's cross sort of industries is a real challenge. So I guess like looking back at your career, Dave, what's been sort of the most unexpected lesson you've learned over the years?
Oh, wow. Unexpected lesson.
Or anything that was a lesson that, you know, sort of directed your career in a certain way just because it was a quite challenging thing to sort of overcome or...
Yeah, I think...
Tough question.
It's a tough question. Yeah, there's two things come to mind. I mean, the first is that people can really surprise you, you know, like I think... especially had their ability to grow. And, you know, like sometimes, especially people that may not have been performing or, you know, have been not necessarily excelling, but then you give them the right challenge, they can grow. I think the other one is probably just the power of humility and I think, again, I feel I can be a bit candid. Going from a role where I felt that I was doing quite well, you know, managing a relatively large team, to a role that I wasn't excelling at, that was hard, and that certainly instilled some humility in me. And it was really good in the end. You know, I really liked what I've been able to do and accomplish in that role. But yeah, the importance of humility in a career. Yeah.
Initially, when you had that transition period, was that quite a sort of confidence knocker for you? Were you feeling a bit like, oh God, this is going to be a really hard challenge, I can't do this? At any points you were feeling like that, but you couldn't do it, or you weren't going to be able to do it?
I never thought I wasn't going to be able to do it, but I certainly felt like confidence knock is the right thing. I actually did something that was really challenging for myself. So I'd started an MBA in a few months before I moved to the DevOps role. And so I was doing a part-time MBA at the same time as I was doing the DevOps thing. And so, I mean, there was just a lot of learning going on everywhere, you know, and different streams. It wasn't like, you know, tech learning, like MBA is not so technical focused and the DevOps was tech focused. So yeah, I think that definitely for the first year, that was really like, I never wanted to leave or anything like that, but it was certainly a confidence knock. And it was hard. Yeah.
Awesome. Let's step away from the tech for a minute and just discuss more about like your passions and your stuff outside of tech.
Mm-hmm.
So what keeps you busy outside of work? What do you enjoy doing?
I mean, I love hiking. I love nature. So me and my girlfriend travel a lot. I have something where I always want to have been to more countries than my age.
Ah.
So I had been to 36 countries when I moved to the UK.
Wow.
And I was 35 at the time. And I've managed to kind of get that to 60 countries now. Wow. So yeah. So so the idea is to kind of like continue doing that. I love, like, mental health is a big passion of mine. I've done a column Level Ups here, so it's really cool. We've got something in Center Business where anyone can talk about anything for an hour, and I did a Level Up on mental health and my journey in mental health, and, you know, my challenges, you know, to be open. You know, I've experienced, like a lot of people, experiencing mental health challenges. I've done a podcast with a friend called Men Talk About Feelings, where we talk about being open around mental health, especially men, which I think globally, but also in the UK, there is a challenge around. Yeah,
definitely. We'll touch on that in a bit for sure. What would you say your favorite country was in, and why? He's been to so many now. So.
Yeah, that's an interesting one.
But you've experienced a lot of different cultures, and I'm expecting to hear something crazy.
Yeah, I mean, Syria was pretty amazing. Yeah, and so I was in Syria and Lebanon in 2005. So that competition was open. It wasn't, you know, obviously you can't go there now. But then there was, at that point in time, there was no problems. And it was a very, very beautiful country there. Bali is probably my favorite. Yeah, for Australia. Yeah, it was close. Yeah, Bali is just like, that country is very magical. Yeah.
Awesome. So you see, on the mental health front, like we said, we discussed that about that before, but I mean, we was getting a little bit passionate about it when we spoke, because it's I think it's almost like I feel like a lot of people are speaking out more about it as well, especially for the mental health in men for sure, because I feel like it's so underspoken and maybe underrepresented as well.
Yeah.
I feel like it's just sort of left behind in that sense. But from your side, why do you think it's so important right now, and sort of your thoughts on that?
So in the UK, the biggest cause of death for men under 45 is suicide. And I think people are recognizing that and recognizing that can change. I think fortunately there's an openness as well, not just in society, but also in companies. Like, you know, I was able to do a talk on my mental health journey, a very candid talk at Simply Business, and that was really welcomed, you know, about the difficulties I've had in certain experiences. And I don't think that would have happened 10 years ago. And I think people are realizing that, like, talking about mental health isn't a bad thing. You know, we can be open. We can, like, we are all human, you know, like, I think it's like 70-80% of people suffer depression at some point in their life. Like, you know, I think we're being open about that, which is great. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we spoke about this in our last podcast as well, but it's, I think it's so industry like dependent. Like, for our industry, for instance, it's so It's almost like they think that there's something wrong with you if you open up about how you feel, or if, I don't know, there's something, you know, that you need to express, which is really weird. But it's really good that companies now, I feel like they're acknowledging it a lot more and it's becoming almost acceptable, like you guys are doing, like you said, just even if it's an hour, just to come in a boardroom or whatnot and just let everything go and just say what needs to be said in a safe space. I think that's really important, especially for the sort of mental health. It doesn't have to be just for men, but I think that's just a part that is quite underdeprived, I think, in, or just not getting enough attention. It's getting there, but it's just still don't think it's there, like, just yet. But I think social media is having a big, like, presence on it, because I feel like they're allowing it to be acceptable now. I feel like they're promoting it, because I feel like they have realized, like you said, it, there's so many suicides and whatnot, just because, like, if men express how they feel, it's almost like a weakness. And it's, yeah, you don't want to be in a society that's pushing that side of things. So
I'm curious to know, why do you think that it's less successful in recruitment than other industries?
I would say because sort of types of people that maybe are in recruitment typically over the last 30, 40 years, I think sales in general, I think, is probably fairly similar. It's very cutthroat. If you don't hit a certain quota, if you don't do 3 deals a month, for example, in one company, you're out the door. And you know, you might be dealing with some really strong depression at that time, or you may have lost a family member, which is making you feel obviously very upset and different emotions. So I think it can be quite, there's not really like a acceptance for failure in recruitment, especially. We've learned that over 5-6 years. I think BTS was having panic attacks quite a lot when he first started recruitment. I'm sure my mind, we spoke about it before, didn't we?
No, for me, it's more so it's recruitment almost tends to be like who wears the biggest pants in the big industries, in the big companies. And this is why we, funny enough, we work for the same company for 3 companies now.
Oh, wow.
So we worked together for a really small company, which we enjoyed, went to a really big corporate, and it was literally like that. It's, they don't value yourself. They don't care really like how you feel. And yeah, I was suffering from panic attacks really badly, like really badly. But I couldn't open up when I was in like the big corporate, just because, again, it's a sign of weakness, and it's not something that's deemed acceptable back then. But I just think recruitment in general is very below where it should be, where it comes to like valuing employees, like mental health and that side of things, because there's so many KPIs, you have to hit targets, and they almost, certain companies especially, don't realize like everyone's human. Like sometimes you just need to like take a step back, and
tech's getting a lot better, isn't it? Tech is definitely becoming a lot better. Most
some like, companies,
not all companies, but I think it's getting better. How do you manage sort of like balance and well-being for you and your team as well? How does that all work, I guess?
So Simply Business is a pretty great company in that respect. We have this openness about mental health. You know, we support people if they do have mental health issues or experience any mental health things. We have a mental health podcast. We've got a mental health network. So I think being open about it is a big support. We have things like employee assistance programs, that sort of stuff, where anyone can call anonymously and get some mental health support. So I think being open about it. We had we had our general counsel give a level up on her experience with bipolar disorder, was really amazing. And this is a board member, and that was huge.
It was really brave.
Yeah, that encouraged me to then give my presentation on depression, anxiety, and trauma. And we had another person give her give a level up on why she stopped drinking, which is sort of a bit of a taboo. But that's like, I don't drink anymore. I haven't drank in years because I find that it just, my life's better without it.
I'm the same at the moment.
Really,
I told you I drank once for the stag, but apart from that, I just sort of like, it's just not good for you, is it?
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of evidence that says this is sort of not that great. But even then, like talking about it, even saying like I don't drink, you know. But at least in SB, there is a lot of openness around this and support. I was interviewed by the Mental Health Network for another podcast, actually. And so I think that helps, you know. I think people, you can always be better in a company, but it's first steps, and that's, or even beyond first steps, is what they do at SB, yeah.
You try to be like quite a hard worker, Dave, and probably works too hard sometimes, MBAs and work and all this stuff. Do you get burnout? And if so, like, how do you deal with burnout?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and for me, that's been a probably a lifelong lesson to figuring it out. And I now have signals that I'm aware of in myself if I'm approaching that, and then I have to just pull back and rest and, you know, like make sure I'm not, but yeah, that has been a challenge for me. But that comes from my family as well. They're,
what signals?
Foggy brain, tiredness, not eating, not exercising, not sleeping properly. You know, I wear an Oura ring to make sure I monitor my sleep and my stress. And yeah, so now I'm much more attuned to that. But before, I would just, you know, make myself sick working. Yeah,
I feel like I think from your side of you've obviously already said like you're very passionate about traveling and that side of things. Obviously that acts as like a big thing to release that burnout side and gives you a clear head, I guess.
It can do, yeah. I mean, it depends on the trip. Like we just went on a trip to where was it? Armenia, Georgia and Armenia. Oh, and wow. It was really cool, but I mean, we just did so many tours that I came back. Yeah. Both of them are really cool. Yeah, I would recommend them. But yeah, we just did too much. We didn't take enough time off. And so now I'm really mindful. I'm doing Norway and Sweden in a few months for the Northern Lights. And that, we just got like one or two tours, a nice cabin overlooking the water.
Sure.
Yeah, very, very chill. Yeah, hiking. Yeah.
And from yourself, I mean, this is again off topic, but are you... From your profile, are you very much into like dough and adventures in dough?
Yeah. So I guess for those listening, I run a small website called Adventures in Dough, where it teaches people how to bake sourdough. It was a lockdown project, and I make sourdough still. I love it. It's a fun little passion project, and it's usually just I think I used to be able to sell it. I've taken that functionality away because it's more about just teaching friends and people that I meet how to do it. Yeah. So I've got this little starter kit that I can give you or anyone else interested, really. Nice. And it's sort of like how to make sourdough. I had a lot of fun making the videos around it. Yeah.
That's really cool. Mm. Awesome. Look, let's dive back into tech.
Yeah.
Right. And let's sort of discuss more about like the evolution of DevOps.
Sure.
And that side of things. So from your side, I mean, you've been in the tech space for a very long time. So how have you seen sort of DevOps evolve over sort of the last decade, and sort of how do you see sort of the current state of DevOps at the moment?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I mean, my main focus DevOps happened 4 years ago when I moved to DevOps. So I was more looking at it from infrastructure and sort of IT support space. I mean, not to be cliche, but the amount of automation that we're going to get, I think, in DevOps will be massive. There's a lot of problems that AI can solve in a lot of areas. There are a lot of problems it can't solve that people think that it can. And, you know, I think we had we do a tech conference in SB every year, and we managed to get the head of AI and machine learning for AWS globally, Shelby, a very, very amazing woman. And she was talking about AI. And it's just sort of like AWS were really interesting. I think their reInvent conference had in like 2023 was like AI is going to solve everything. And 2024 is very much like more specific use cases, you know? And really, yeah. So you probably would have seen that then. Yeah, it kind of. And I think AI is fantastic. I'm sure we're going to talk about it. But I think that there is specific areas that it can solve only. And there's a lot of stuff that it can't, that everyone's sort of figuring out. So I think back to Shelby. She said that if your AI use case can get things right 50 to 80% of the time, you're doing well. So she envisioned that you would never have medical use cases for AI, which I tend to agree, you know. You might have it augmented, but you'll always have a human there. And I think there's a lot of use cases where you can't. So with DevOps, a lot of like log analytics, which we're testing now, a lot of automation, a lot of you know, I guess like pipeline review and that kind of stuff can be assisted with AI. And so I see that happening there. I think that's sort of like definitely evolving to integrate AI. I mean, we're seeing it a lot now with like vibe coding, and you know, we're testing out a bunch of different ones, including Cursor and Copilot, and that's, you know, for certain use cases, creating a huge amount of productivity increases as well.
I guess, considering that Simply Business are like an AWS house,
mm-hmm.
Which tools within sort of the DevOps function are like a non-negotiable? Like they have to be used, whether it's daily, weekly. I know they can change month by month, but typically, like, what tools do you have to have in terms of your suite?
Oh yeah, cool. So we have we call it the internal developer platform, the IDP, and we have like the Backplane, which we use Backstage. So that's the Spotify kind of thing, and that's sort of the front door for the developer, where you see all your apps and where you can kind of your templates and things like that. We have the Brave New World, which is our deployment pipeline platform, which uses AWS, which is a combination of code build and GitHub Actions. For monitoring logging, we have New Relic, and so all that logging goes in there. And for security, we use things like Okta. And then obviously the resource plane is just standard AWS stuff. So a user will, let's say, when I create an app, they'll be able to use a lot of templates in Backstage, and that'll deploy things automatically, and then they'll heavily customize that through our different control planes.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Any sort of more container-based stuff you guys use? Obviously, Control Plane, no company that sort of...
No, Control Plane is our...
No, not the company.
This is our visualization of it. So right. Like each internal developer platform has different control planes. That is how we talk about. So we talk about like the observability control plane, which we use for New Relic. You could use Datadog or something like that. But we sort of visualize our internal developer platform with these five different planes. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Container-based solutions? Do you have any sort
predominantly of container-based? Yeah. So we use ECS. So on AWS, we don't use EKS because we found even at the scale we're operating at, ECS works fine. So
hear that a lot, by the way.
Really interesting.
Yeah.
I posted an article. I think it was this morning actually. How in 2025 there is a lot of small to sort of medium-sized environments that aren't implementing Kubernetes at all because the benefits don't outweigh the cost.
Mm.
And because it's so expensive, there's alternative ways to get around it.
Yeah.
So it's really not needed. And a lot of people are just trying to avoid it all in general. So it is becoming almost a commonality, I think.
Yeah. I mean, we have at different stages looked at it. And again, we can't, at the points we've looked at it, we couldn't justify the complexity that it would add, you know? Yeah,
that's another big thing as well, for sure. Look, diving back into the AI side of things, when, you know, we were just sort of discussing how, I guess there is use sort of cases for it, but like, I guess it has to be used in the right way for it to be effective. How are you sort of using it at the moment at Simply Business? Because I know before we discussed, you know, you've done like Slack bots and that side of things, which he was very sort of proud of as well. So how have you sort of implemented AI into Simply Business? And how has that been for you, I guess?
Yeah, so I'll probably share about the Slack bots because that's the sort of use case that I know best about. And like a lot of companies, I think we're doing AI in very different, a lot of different ways. Like touching on what I think we started building our own, we've just recently started building our own clusters to do local inference, to tune models. I think that's what we're doing. I wasn't too involved with the project. We're doing a lot in our, how we engage with customers as well, and like understanding customer behavior and things too. But for me personally, I originally built a Slack bot, and it was really just for people engaging with the DevOps team. So we use Slack predominantly for when people ask us questions, they'll ask us questions in Slack. And I noticed that someone would ask a question and then a few months later, someone would ask the same question. And often the role of the person who was on support was to look at the error message, search through Slack to try and find where someone asked it before, and then use that solution. So I thought, could we make this better with a bot. So we set up a very basic bot where we exported the Slack channel for the last year or two, put that into a knowledge base, and then asked the bot a question, you know, and tested that. And it was pretty cool. You know, at the time, we didn't have measurements to say like how well it was doing, but we were like, okay, this sort of like temp check, it's asking, it's answering stuff okay. So then we went through a bit of refinement process, prompt engineering with a bot. So the team that I work for is platform engineering and services team, and we call ourselves PEST. And so it's PEST bot that we were using. And with refinements, we launched it. And it was pretty good. So, you know, people were using it. A couple of people were using it a lot, and that was sort of taking away some support cases. And we found, I think at the time, 5 to 10% of our support cases were being answered by that. And then what I really love about AI, and what I think the art in it is about the tuning. Like, you can get an LLM and you can ask questions and you can take that answer, you know, and you'll probably find, at least in my experience, 30% of the time you'll get something good, and the rest of the time you'll be like, I don't know, what is it, you know? Yeah. And so the art is really like, how do you ask the right questions? How do you do the prompt engineering? How do you manage the data? And so I used AWS has some really cool evaluation tools where you get an LLM, and we got 55 test questions, and we were like, answer these questions, and then we were able to get a number, like, you know, how well our bot is performing. And I think the first time we ran this question set, it was 35% right, which is okay. We actually thought it was better, but I think some of the test questions were a bit harder. But we had a sort of thing that we could test with. And so then we sort of did some more iterations, started tweaking. And that testing, that sort of test-driven development, I think was really powerful for us, and is also powerful in LLMs anywhere, because you've got that baseline that you can say, okay, this is the use case. So, and then we just started testing more. Went to 35, 40, 45, 50. I think we're at 75% on the test cases now. And realistically, because some of those test questions are hard, I think the bot is probably answering anywhere between 80 to 95% of the questions that we get asked right. And it's constantly learning, because it basically ingests the Slack channel daily. So that means if you ask a question and it gets the answer wrong, as long as someone says that was wrong and this is right, that then becomes part of his knowledge base, and it's right, yeah. So this is really cool. So we did this with PestBot, and then as I said, I used to work in BizOps, the IT support infrastructure one, and we got 30, 40, 50 cases a week kind of thing. I think they'd get like, you know, 300 a week that people constantly asking. And so I spoke to the BizOps lead at the time, and I said, do you want to test this out? You know, can we try it on yours? And we tried it, and it was really positive, you know, it was really cool. And again, we went through the same iteration, same testing, and that one got quite high too. And now in PEST, I think the bot is answering 20, 25% of our cases. And then in BizOps, it's answering 33% of the cases autonomously. This is autonomously, so without anyone. So it's you know, doing a lot of the... Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that doesn't translate to 30% less work, unfortunately. You know, there's nuances around it, especially the type of cases that it answers, obviously the easier ones, but it's definitely taking that. But really, what's also awesome is, as a business, we're able to move faster. Like, you know, if someone, and people are asking these bots questions themselves. So instead of waiting for someone to answer, you know, 5, 10, 15, 30 minutes, half an hour, and your flow gets stopped. Both on the DevOps side and the BizOps side, you get instant answers that are usually more often than not right. So we had that one bot, two bots. We now got 10 bots around the business. So all these different things that are being implemented. And the framework that I've built makes it quite easy to stand up a bot and test it. So we're doing some of those bots, you know, we stand up, we test, it doesn't work, we pull it down. But a lot of them are doing good stuff in some way, shape or form.
Do you think there would ever be a point where it could work fully autonomously without, because I know you said it's almost to a point where how do you use AI and there still has to be a human touch to it in certain elements. Do you think in the future there'll be a point where it could work autonomously without the sort of human interaction, if it sort of keeps learning and keeps or do you think it's not, it would need that human touch?
I think like AI is really interesting when you think about it in that sense and philosophically, because humans need supervision as well, you know? So I think the best we'll probably get it to is not, I don't think it'll be like a human, but it'll be sort of closer to that. Like, you still have to monitor it. You still have to see it. I think you get to understand what it can and can't give you the more you work with, you know, a particular bot or a particular data source. And so we definitely, a lot of these tasks that it's doing now, we'll be able to say, okay, we can do it a lot of the time. But I mean, it's every answer will be different. So it may get it right 99% of the time and then may fail 1%. So I don't think it'll be completely autonomous. There are definitely people that do, and some people listening might be saying I'm full of shit, but that's my my opinion and experience working with it.
Everyone's got a different opinion. Yeah. Honestly, some people absolutely hate it. But what are some of the challenges that you faced when you were sort of implementing the Slackbots? Was it sort of all pretty sort of explanatory, or was it or was there anything that any hiccups sort of down the road?
Definitely around, like, until we had a testing process, that was difficult because we would release a bot and then we go, you know, is it good? How do we understand? So getting the test-driven development was good. There were definitely some people that didn't really want to engage with the bots on the side of the teams that were helping with it, you know, so didn't like pulling in the bots to conversation, didn't like automation, and that's a personal preference.
Why was that? Do you know why those sort of people didn't want to get involved with that?
Or? I can only guess, but I think it's maybe worry about it taking a job or supporting something that I might be taking a job away, versus not liking change, you know, so a lot of different things, yeah.
Well, what sort of worries you about AI as an engineer and also a leader of a team as well? What scares you about the ability it's sort of quickly expanding on, I guess?
I think I worry what the world will look like in 20 years.
Yeah, I'm scared already.
Yeah, from like...
Even 5 years.
And it's interesting because there is research that says AI will take away 95 million jobs or whatever and create 130 million. So, you know, there's like, that's US research, but, I think AI is really powerful. I like to think of it as, Steve Jobs called a computer a bicycle for the mind. And I like to think AI can be that. Like, I use it as a tool. I've had it enhance sentences for me or write like ideas down and then flesh that out. And I find that works really well. I think there's a danger in offloading too much of your mind to it. And so you're just like, do this work for me, in which case disconnect from the creative process and you don't learn from it. And I'm very cautious about doing that. But, you know, speaking to my girlfriend's a teacher, and, you know, she talks about students and how she's an English teacher and how managing that with AI. And,
oh, God, yeah.
You know, and interesting, you see students that were struggling and then all of a sudden their style completely changed and like, okay, look, you know, these M dashes are giving it away. You're using ChatGPT. Yeah, so I worry, but also at the same respect, I kind of feel like it probably could be analogous to the Industrial Revolution, you know, when we went from, you know, like automated manufacturing to manual stuff and what that meant. And I think it could be a positive change for society. I kind of fear, again, being philosophical, AI is very powerful and can be weaponized, and there's a fear around that, you know, yeah. But that's from a tech standpoint, I think it is really going to change things in a great way. What I think too is just like, it's like the internet. Like when the internet came out, it was like, it's just going to do all these things, or blockchain, for example. And I think AI has some amazing use cases that we're still discovering and will be discovering for 20 years. But I think there's this tendency to think that it's just going to solve everything and fix every business problem and change every business. And I don't think that's the case. Yeah.
I think it's scary because I think not just for tech, but for other industries, I think even for like airlines, for example, if they start having like robots as like cabin crew and like in supermarkets have actual robots doing the work, it's more productive, really. Like they're not going to get tired. They're going to work at the same pace all day. They haven't got bones, muscles to sort of rely on to walk around. They just got, you know, they're told what to do and that's it. So they already have robots working in like the Amazon factories and stuff. Yeah. They're robots. Also
the Amazon food shop.
Oh, the food shop. Yeah.
Like there's no like people that work there. It's just, you just take your...
Well, it's interesting though. Have you been into one of those?
No.
Because I went into one in Angel, and when it first opened, I was like, this is cool, and it happened. Then I went again and there's a person at the counter going, scan. Yeah, they stopped using it. Yeah.
I've been into that one in Angel.
Yeah.
Near the biggest square.
Yeah. I think like...
the whole USB.
But it was like, I think you could still do it. Like the guy was like... This was it. So I went to leave and the guy was like, you've got to scan it. And I'm like, go to the checkout thing. I'm like, no, but I want to actually use my Amazon account. He's like, oh, okay. He's like, open your Amazon app and then get this QR code. You scan this QR code and it charges your Amazon app, which is kind of cool. But he was like pushing everyone just to use the thing, which is kind of kind of funny.
It's expensive in that shop as well, by the way.
Is it?
Food's really, yeah. It's
I
really,
just bought a snack there.
Yeah. But I think a meal deal was like £6-7.
Really?
Yeah, it's quite expensive. Yeah. So.
It's not too fun though. I like AI as a support tool.
Yeah.
But I feel like a lot of people in the current day are dependent on it.
Yeah.
I feel like in the tech space, especially what we've seen is like the junior to sort of mid-levels are almost maybe relying on it too much. And it is a little bit obvious, but especially, it depends what environment they're joining. But if they're joining like a startup company, for instance, or a smaller environment, you're going to get found out from over like using like AI. For me personally, like I like to use it. I don't know if it was to do some research about something, but I don't like using it for doing my work for me, because I just feel like you lose that personal touch. And for me, I can see when AI is being used, and I don't know, I just don't think it's, I don't want to say it's like a cheat code or like a, just almost like a, it's like a shortcut, but I just feel like people might get too dependent on it as it keeps developing, because it does make tasks a lot easier. I think it's just finding the balance of like what's acceptable and what isn't.
Yeah, I am hearing sort of the things around that. Like I've coded for quite a while, and so what I find is AI is great to augment coding, but it makes so many mistakes or goes down the wrong path, and kind of like the thing, like it will just recreate a function rather than try and edit a function or something like that, and then mess things up. So you really, or at least when I work with it, I really have to watch it. I have to be really careful with the prompt engineering and also watch it. And if I didn't have that coding experience, I think it'd be very easy to run away. And this is the kind of thing that I'm hearing, is that people that are kind of junior engineers that don't have that kind of experience around it could get a bit lost when it kind of goes the wrong way or something like that, and then need someone to support them. And I think there's a big risk there, you know, is that like if we are junior engineers learning with AI and not knowing how to kind of guide it, then, you know, that can be problematic.
I think what we're actually seeing a lot of this is that companies actually are reluctant to hire juniors at the moment.
Interesting.
It's really bad. Well, I think it's quite bad because the sort of next generation aren't really getting many chances to sort of go into the industry. And I think AI's had a part to play in that because companies don't trust them to come in and actually learn everything themselves. Yeah. There's no need anymore. So they'd rather hire someone that's senior on a good salary that's been there, done it without the AI.
Yeah.
I can use that to then really, you know, work with them and make them even better. So
yeah,
with you, it's so funny. Someone was in an interview. Obviously, just this is recorded, but maybe they wanted to be seen. But they had a phone recording the question, and the AI was answering the questions for him.
Oh, really?
So they're reading out the answers, what's being recorded through the phone.
Oh, no.
So have you experienced anything like that in, you know, I don't know, interviews or anything like that, where you, I don't know, you see maybe like AI is being used or just, I don't know, something like that?
Yeah, it's happened. I personally haven't experienced, but I've heard of people having candidates, you know, either have like AI recording it and then giving answers, or people just typing and looking up the answer and giving the exact answer when they do it. It's an interesting thing though. I want to go back to what you're talking about the junior engineers, because I love your perspective as not only recruiters, but also, you know, as people in the tech industry. You said that companies are hungry for senior engineers, and you know, junior ones aren't being hiring, but what's going to happen in 5-10 years when those seniors retire or start to move out and we haven't got any more juniors? Like, how does this problem get solved?
I'm not sure is the honest answer, because we've seen it happening for the past 18 months now. I think we've only had maybe sort of like 3 or 4 junior roles, and we've had more than 50 senior roles. So I think, I mean, we speak with obviously people like yourself, similar sort of levels quite a lot. And I think, like I said, once again, they need someone that's been there and done it and actually knows their stuff without the AI stuff. And I think obviously ChatGPT came out 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago.
It was November 2022, yeah.
So nearly 3 years ago now. And I think from that point on, I think the world sort of changed forever in terms of the tech hiring and how it's going to work.
Wow.
Graduate roles are sort of, God, I mean, I feel sorry for I do a lot of work with graduates to try and support them with the search, just out of my free time in the evenings and stuff. And the amount of graduates sort of apply for one role, I think it's something like 150 per role normally, so that we see. Yeah. It's really sad because they've just finished their university degree and they're excited to get into the real world of work and making money and having a career.
Yeah.
And they're taking a year to get a job. Really smart people as well. Getting two ones at university.
Wow.
Red Brick universities as well.
Wow.
So,
I think what it is now, I think what it's come to is you almost have to master something and then transition into it. Or know someone. Yeah. But it has to be almost like, we always speak to so many people that want to get into DevOps. And we always say, like, you should look at the route you want to take.
Yeah.
So if, for instance, like you went through the infrastructure route.
Yeah.
If the infrastructure route is the route you want to do, master something in infrastructure.
Yeah.
Go down that route. Because a lot of people just expect that DevOps role, that junior DevOps role. Doesn't exist.
Yeah.
But if you go down the infrastructure route, master the infrastructure stuff, ask to get involved in, like, I don't know, some automation tasks or something to do with pipelines or anything like that. Yeah, literally. And then the transition is easy because there is companies out there that, for a mid-level, for instance, if you've come from a strong infrastructure background and you've got, you know, elements of, say, automation or some infrastructure as code, some scripting, they will take the leap on that. They can do that. But it's you almost have to master something before you get there. Because we always get this question, like, how do I get into DevOps? And we always say, like, either choose an infrastructure role or choose the software route and master an area within that route and then transition into DevOps. Don't look at the short goal, look at the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people just want a junior DevOps role. They don't exist.
Yeah.
They really don't exist.
I think David's done it a really good way where he's sort of like come from that infra background and you've sort of come into the UK obviously sort of 9-10 years ago and you've joined Simply and you started in BizOps and doing more sort of support type work and then
supporting infrastructure
type work and you've done more sort of automation stuff around that and then you've actually moved within the same company into DevOps in quotation marks, whatever DevOps is these days.
Yeah.
Right? So you've done what I think is the best thing to do is find a company that has like a DevOps function already built into it and then move into that and get the chance, prove yourself firstly, show what you can do, show you're a great engineer, problem solver, etc. Then you can get that chance.
Yeah.
I think moving companies from like a support role into a DevOps role, we never see it.
Yeah.
We never ever see it. So it's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough
out there. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
If you had to do everything again, Dave, what would you change if there is anything that you would change or refine?
I mean, I don't really have too many regrets, you know. Yeah. I mean, there's a pair of really tight leather pants I bought when I was 16. No, I'm kidding. honestly, yeah, I don't know if I'd do much different, you know. I kind of think I'm really happy with the career I've had. It's been really interesting and varied. Working in two countries, it's been amazing. Like working in London is amazing. In the same in Sydney, we didn't cover it, but I worked for Universal Music for a few years, which was just nice. Like, I love music, so that was fantastic. So yeah, it's hard to think about anything that I'd change. Yeah.
What genre of music do you like, David?
Hip hop,
old school or like
old school? Yeah.
American English or sort of like
American English Australian. Yeah, but like old school stuff. So like the 90s,
like Biggie, Tupac, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And
music.
Oh, really?
I'm trying. I'm learning. No, I've got like a home studio that I've built.
Cool.
Past like a year or so.
Yeah.
I started making beats. Wasn't the best at it. To be fair, brilliant. I'm learning. But like now I'm sort of producing sort of other people's music and sort of trying to mix and master and that sort of stuff. So I'm my own as well. And he's just there laughing at me. You know what? Like you said earlier about the mental health stuff, just touching that again, I think for me, my career, I do work long days and it's a lot of stress. So for me to have like something where it's almost my escape. Yeah. And I think it's a bit of maybe a weird hobby to have, but I don't really care. It's fun for me to do that. So it's really, but music for me, I love music.
I don't think it's a weird hobby at all. I think like, you know, doing something like that, a creative that like, you know, uses that part in mind. So I like, I'm learning guitar, singing, and dancing.
Really?
Yeah. I do like three lessons or two lessons 1 week and then one every other week. And that is to use like that different part of my mind.
Oh, yeah.
And since I've been doing that, it's like the creativity that kind of I get that spills into other things has been huge. And it's really funny too, because I can honestly code for 16 hours straight. And like, you know, my girlfriend will have to drag me away from the computer to sleep, but I just can focus so much on that and that's fine. But like an hour of playing guitar, my brain tired, you know? Yeah.
I think for me, like 2 or 3 hours in the studio is like, that's me done for the weekend.
Yeah.
little collab. You can dance in my video. Here's a video.
No, when you send me the videos, now let's send it to David.
I'd love to take a look. Yeah.
No. I'm too embarrassed. Until I go mainstream, I'm not telling anybody that I know it. So fair play. With the singing and dancing and stuff, yeah. Is it like a vocal coaching? Are you getting
it's a singing coach and the guitar coach. So just like guitar tutor. So just playing guitar once a week. And I have no desires to do anything with it besides karaoke. And it's really interesting. So I feel like, again, this is more on the mindfulness and the mental health stuff, but I feel like connecting with your body is really important for mental health, you know? And you can do that through a few different ways, through hiking, through nature, but also like your voice is your instrument. It's the one you're born with, right? Mm. You know? And actually the singing has helped me to be able to project my voice more, be more eloquent and confident. Yeah. And the guitar as well is like...
You may have noticed I speak, I don't project my voice as much as like Vitas does and most other people do.
Yeah.
So I actually struggle with the podcast. This is quite a struggle for me because I have to sort of shout to get the words out.
Interesting.
And it's weird because in recruitment, obviously my job and stuff, I sort of like, it's almost like you're a different person.
Yeah.
So you're sort of putting a persona on to speak on the phone and do that stuff. But in normal life, I'm very quiet and I don't speak properly.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And the eloquent stuff, I think, like you said there, I think the singing does help with that a bit as well.
Have you done singing lessons?
No.
So I've got a singing teacher that is really good and not very expensive. I can share the details
with you. Yeah, that'd be good.
He's good because I found that I had one singing teacher and he was not great.
Really?
And he was just not that great. But I've been using this new guy for 6 months and my voice is like, let's just put it this way, my girlfriend doesn't like look at me funny when I try and sing karaoke.
That's
now.
Good. Yeah. I've got a great teacher as well called Autotune.
And it's, oh, yeah.
Does a good job, to be fair. Does a good job. But I guess Vitas, over to you.
Yeah. So what we'll do is we'll just reflect back on sort of the conversation a little bit before we finish. But from yourself then, just going back into the tech side to sort of finish off. Where do you see like DevOps and AI overlapping in the next 5 years? Where do you see that sort of heading towards, I guess?
Mm.
I mean, I guess it covers a lot of the stuff we mentioned already, but where do you think the integration and sort of collaboration, I guess, with them two, where do you see it sort of going?
Yeah. I think so. We did touch on that already. You know, I think like a lot of the automated log analysis and things like that, that's the things we're playing with. I think like creating app, like DevOps, you know, the standard thing, spin up an app, deploy the app, monitor the app. All that should be able to be made a lot easier. You know, like if we can get a conversational kind of thing, instead of someone having to read a bunch of documents and going to say, deploy it, you know, please deploy my app. And then it asks, what are the configurations, that kind of thing. I think we could see a lot more, ease for the developer around that. I mean, already that's what DevOps is about, is making it, you know, life easier for the developer. Yeah. But I can see a lot becoming a lot easier. Yeah. Which is the sort of stuff we're starting to experiment with as well. Yeah.
So from your side as well, I mean, you've been in the tech space for a very long time. For someone that, say, was starting their career as, you know, let's say, you know, an infra engineer, what advice would you give them to sort of shape their future, I guess?
Yeah.
Get to Dave's level.
I think like...
Work at Simply Business.
If you're lucky enough to get a job at somewhere like that, or somewhere like in your best music, yeah. I mean, I've had a lot of luck, which
helps, right?
Which helps, yeah. But I also have worked really hard for that luck. You know, so I've done 2 master's degrees and, you know, after failing high school, which is like, that was, for me, it was important because I kind of you know, prove myself exactly for my own reasons and some personal things that were going on at the time. I wasn't really able to apply myself. So to be able to prove myself. And so I do feel like I did have a lot of luck, but I also do feel like that was deserved because I worked really, really hard and do work really, really hard. As far as advice goes, is what I would give to anyone, which is just do what you love, not what you think you should do or what you think would bring the money. Like, you know, I've always followed what I can sit and do for 16 hours straight and then get up and do 16 hours again. You know, like there's a part of me that I think a lot of developers will have where they're just, you can get into that flow state with code. And I'm lucky enough that that was me, you know, and I've been able to follow that. And if you're wanting to get into DevOps or something, or you just do what you love, you know, if what you happen to love is English, then that's what you should be doing, you know, or follow that. You can definitely, if you're really curious about DevOps, like I don't want to say like go away from that path, but I think try and make sure that you combine that and don't sort of push yourself into things that you don't love. Yeah.
I think once you find the love, I think it doesn't become like a job, does it? It's like you said, it just, you don't mind waking up. If anything, you look forward to it.
Yeah.
You wake up and you're like, oh yeah, I'm looking forward to this.
Exactly.
Like, I actually don't think I've had a day where I woke up and I'm like, oh, can't bother today.
Yeah,
like it's because we actually love what we do, and
exactly
when you find that, I think just go with it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I feel the same. Like I feel really lucky to have been able to explore that. But yeah, that's it. Like I know people that try and explore things or do things because someone says they should, and at least that's not the path for me. Yeah.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. And like I mentioned before we started, but the way we finish off, Dave, is we get the previous person to ask a question for you, and for you to ask a question for the next person that's going to be on our podcast. So the previous question was, what's the biggest challenge you face in your career so far, and how did you overcome it?
So I think probably the biggest challenge was that the movement into DevOps at the same time I was doing a master's degree. That was just a lot of work to take on at one time. And I overcame it with grit. You know, it really was just like, speaking openly about mental health, that was a difficult time for me. You know, that was a lower point from a mental health perspective. And it was just putting one foot in front of the other every day, you know, and getting up and doing the work, like exercising when I didn't want to because I knew it was good for mental health, go for a run, meditate, like pushing myself. It wasn't anything magical. It was just grit. And also, I mean, I will add to that I'm given the opportunity, I would do it again. Like it was really hard, but it was so rewarding. Yeah, all of that.
Nice. And what's your question for the next guest?
Good question.
Could be anything. Anything you
want. Yeah.
What's your favorite pizza?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, what's one place on the world you want to visit and why? Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. Good stuff. Awesome. And for our listeners, where's the best place to find you, Dave?
LinkedIn. Yeah. So David.Ferrid, I think, on LinkedIn. I guess you put something in the notes. Absolutely. But yeah. So find me on LinkedIn or Adventures in Dough. Yeah, adventuresindo.co.uk, I think it is, yeah.
For the free guide,
yeah, on how to make sourdough. Happily help anyone make sourdough, yeah.
Awesome. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, thank you very much, guys. It was a pleasure.
Cheers.